So those of you who are regular listeners know that we're learning here. We're Emily in training. Emily training to be a full and equal, or maybe even greater than equal, partner in Tossed Salad. You can turn Al's microphone on too. Mr. Cairns probably is going to chime in even before I ask him a question. So Emily is now running the board. I am doing my first ever interview of someone on Tossed Salad without having to run the board at the same time.
Nice. So we'll see if I'm, hands.
Look, Mom, no hands. Well, except I have notes in my hands. Al Cairns, a pleasure always to see you.
And you.
How's life?
Excellent.
Life on the farm?
Fantastic.
Al's mic needs to be up as far as it'll go, which is probably where it is already. You are the Environmental Compliance Manager.
Officer.
Oh, I did actually announce you as an officer earlier.
Oh, thank
you. And did you ever imagine yourself as an officer, Al?
No, decidedly not.
Uh-huh. But yeah. You didn't write your job title.
I didn't, nor did I assign myself the officer title there.
Uh-huh. And you've been on the job?
Just shy of 2 years now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It has been that long.
It has.
So you were with the county for a good while.
7 years with Public Works.
Even that seems amazing to me. But when I first met you, you were doing something. You were not pushing paper. You were pushing diesel.
Large diesel engines, yes.
And can you elaborate, please?
I spent 20 years at sea as a merchant marine, and principally in the engine room. As a chief engineer on tugboats, almost exclusively for those 20 years.
Uh-huh. Why the change in the work that you do? It's a radical change.
It was a pretty drastic change. I had a moment of grave realization that maybe my career should be timed out there, where I woke up on a plane flying from New York City back home to here, to the Olympic Peninsula. And I woke up mid-flight somewhere over, I think, the Continental Divide, and had a mild panic attack where I could not remember whether I was going to work or coming home. And I had to look outside the plane to see which side of the plane the sun was on to figure out whether I was coming or going. And it was then that I decided that I probably should set off on a new career path.
So that you could be here all the time?
That's right.
Interesting decision, because I faced the same thing in about 1982 or 3. I was trying to have city money while living in Chimicum. And that's a lot of running around.
Yeah.
And I just didn't like it. And I decided, at that point, I was not in an airplane, and I don't think I even fell off a horse like St. Paul did, but I did realize that I wanted my money to come from here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted to be that tied in that way, and I didn't want to be driving.
Yes.
You are the Environmental Compliance Officer. I'd like you to tell me how you get the environment to comply.
It's tricky. It's everywhere, right? In the manner that I perform my job, what I'm doing is inviting all of our boatyard customers at the Ports Boat Haven facility to more strictly apply the best management practices that we have in place to control any of the pollutant loads that are generated by their work activities.
So guys like me are the environment, and you're trying to get us to comply, and that's that can
right.
be difficult, because some people are not compliant.
Yes, that's very true. But it's funny, you know, don't often have to raise my voice outside of just to be heard over the environmental background noise there, if you will, because I do have a letterhead that I can use, and I do have probably the biggest hammer in Jefferson County, which is our 300-ton travel lift. So we do have the option of inviting people out of our facility if they absolutely won't comply with the environmental controls that we have in place.
So in the years that I worked around the Boat Haven, I'm a marine electrician, worked around the Boat Haven for 20, 25 years, I don't know exactly, but there was not a compliance officer. There were, at some point early on, no regulations, really. Or if there were, nobody knew what they were. Why the change?
To give an example, in 1997, when the port spent a sizable sum of money reconfiguring its Boat Haven facility there into the current configuration that we all enjoy now, the only standard for stormwater quality in place at that time was a measure of turbidity, the level of silt that would be discharged out of our outfall pipe. Since then, a number of other parameters, copper, lead, and zinc, have been introduced into the boatyard general permit, which is issued by the Department of Ecology, and it's under those guidelines that we're able to operate. So three new constituent parts to our stormwater since 1997. And, of course, the benchmarks or the goals, if you will, in terms of the quality of that stormwater have shifted to be more narrowly confining as far as the amount of constituent parts of heavy metals in that discharge.
So there's materials in the ground, on boats, in the air, I guess, in the Boat Haven, and for that matter, everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they discharged into the water?
Well, they enter into the stormwater by means of being driven off of the surface area there, the gravel, and then they enter into our stormwater system. We've got I haven't ever taken the time to measure how many miles, perhaps, of stormwater piping are underneath the soils there, but they all discharge through 82 separate catch basins. And then they move through seven different distinct catch basin areas into one of four vaults that we have, large settling tanks. And then at a certain point, they all converge and discharge through a 48-inch pipe that goes right into our marina.
And where is that? I don't remember it, actually.
It's right next to the 300-ton travel lift pier.
This infrastructure, how long has it been in place?
Since 1997.
And that was funded by the Department of Ecology?
Funding came through a general bond.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How well does it work?
I have to tell you that for all of the area that's covered there, I think it's 14 acres, we've got roughly a 5-foot fall between the highest elevation in the boatyard and the discharge pipe, outfall A as we know it. That is not a lot of slope to work with. We're talking about less than 2% grade. So kudos to the engineers that pulled off that that feat of being able to convey that much stormwater with such a narrow drop in elevation to work with. Near impossible thing to do. What that means is that our system remains wet for a lot of the year. And so various sumps and catch basins and vaults remain forever underwater. And so one of the larger issues that we're dealing with is the amount of silt that gathers in there and, of course, the heavy metal load that might be in that silt as well. So that requires periodic cleaning of the whole system, which, as you might imagine, is not an inexpensive thing to do.
Is that done by port staff?
No, it's not. No, we hire a vendor to do that. It takes very specialized equipment to do that.
How frequently?
We don't do it that often because the amount of silt that's gathered in the vaults is not that great, so it takes a number of years before it's built up. We're planning on doing that this year. Which would coincide all of the other infrastructure improvements that we're affecting right now.
That's almost like mining, isn't it? I was just thinking that all of the metals that are in that silt that you're talking about, there's zinc, there's copper, there's tin, there's probably lead.
Cadmium, chromium.
Is it recycled in any way?
It's not. No, I'm afraid it's not. I wish the value of that material was a bit higher, but, of course, everything's market-driven, and so, you know.
So it just goes into a landfill somewhere?
It does.
Uh-huh. I wonder where. East side of the mountains, I suppose.
Probably. I would imagine, looking at the – I haven't gone through this process myself yet in the time that I've been there, but looking at the Rickard Metal's report, the analysis, lab analysis of the levels of all of those different metals that were just mentioned and a few more, it didn't register high enough to be categorized as hazardous waste, so it was allowed to be landfilled in a Class D landfill, which is, for us in this area, that'd be the Roosevelt Regional Landfill in Klickitat County. It's about 350 miles away from here.
It's interesting to me that what cannot go into the water is not hazardous waste when it's gathered together in silt.
Isn't that interesting?
It's ironic. And maybe I could say more. But then again, if it didn't matter, you wouldn't have your job, would you?
That's right.
And I would think that of – and Emily, by the way, you're welcome to chime in here. And I'm not looking at you because I'm looking at Al, but you know how to interrupt, I think. You want to interrupt?
Oh, not at this exact second, but I will.
Okay. You could throw a spit wad at me or tap me on the shoulder. We have a different geometry here now. We're working these things out. This is the first. As I said, the first time that
the chairs are completely different.
Yeah. I don't know who the chairman or chairwoman is, but we're learning a new way. Anyway, the metals that I would have thought were the ones of greatest concern, especially copper, because there's so much copper in bottom veins. And by the way, we are going to talk about the marina. We're right now, and we've been all along since the start, talking about the boatyard, which is one set of issues, the marina, I assume, another. But with the boatyard, suddenly the problem is zinc. And, you know, I look around at all the metal roofs, at all the chain link fencing, all the galvanized things, not in the boatyard, in the whole wide world, but in the boatyard too. I guess there is a lot of zinc about, but I was surprised that that became an issue. Who made that an issue, I guess I'll ask?
Well, I think a growing awareness of the effect of zinc in the Salish Sea on marine life, particularly salmon and other fish as well. With a growing awareness of there, then there became a greater alarm and a greater call for curbing the amount of zinc that's discharged into the Salish Sea. But as you pointed out, zinc is everywhere. It is maybe, well, certainly for a marine environment or coastal environment, one of the most ubiquitous heavy metals that could be found. As you pointed out, it's in galvanized fencing, roofs, tires by weight are 1% zinc, treated lumber. It's everywhere.
Why is zinc in tires? What is it doing there?
I don't know
either, do you?
What effect does it have on salmon? Does it affect their ability to smell? Would be one guess that I would have. I'm under the impression that copper can have that effect on salmon.
Both of those do have that effect. Zinc is a little bit more problematic because it has the potential to actually affect their DNA. So if you can imagine an entire fishery affected, you know, at that level of their development, that's pretty problematic and worrisome.
Has anybody studied how far from the boat haven the discharge in the boat haven travels?
No, and I would really enjoy somebody to look at that, and particularly to measure or to do a comparative analysis of what the background level of zinc in the Salish Sea is relative to what our discharge is. I think it would paint a clearer picture of the scale to which our facility might be harming the Salish Sea. I would imagine that it would be pretty small.
So you have, and I would imagine with the help of an engineer or two, implemented what seems to me a pretty innovative strategy for capturing zinc, at least off of roofs, and there's many metal roofs in a boat haven. Describe that.
There's a local entrepreneur that came to us last year and said, you should be looking at biochar. Biochar was created by some very innovative people in the Amazon basin about 2,500 years ago as a agricultural soil amendment, and they were able to basically turn nearly infertile soil, or soil that definitely would not support the type of agriculture that large societies would need. They were able to convert that into some of the most fertile soil on the planet. Terra Petra is what it's called. And this biochar that they created was by taking woody material and then firing it in a low oxygen, high heat setting. They were able to create something similar to granular activated carbon. But of course, granular activated carbon, as we know it today, requires chemical infusions, and it in itself creates a large carbon footprint and contributes to greenhouse gas emissions, whereas biochar is considered carbon neutral. So there's a lot of benefit there, and of course, it's a lot cheaper to produce. So Francesco Tortorici is the local gentleman that I mentioned, a big promoter of biochar here, who had networked with a number of people and brought a fellow named John Miedema to us, and they produced for the port some limited bench model results from the biochar that they were studying. And so that definitely piqued our interest. Particularly when we had moved into what's called a level 3 response to stormwater benchmark exceedances, meaning that 6 or more times we had failed to achieve the benchmarks of the goals that ecology had set forth for us. And so that required an engineer to develop a report, a proposal of sorts, to Department of Ecology staff on how we were going to affect changes within our operations that would curb those exceedances and bring us into compliance with to be able to meet those standards.
And the biochar, I think, is in those totes.
It
that
is.
They're stacked right next to all the buildings.
That's right.
So people can see what we're talking about. They don't want to go look right now because they're listening to us, of course. Listening, in fact, to me talking to Al Cairns, the environmental compliance officer for the Port of Port Townsend, who came up with the notion of stacking these intermediate bulk containers one atop another?
That was a product of a collaborative effort between Miles Gray, who's a research assistant with Oregon State University, Francesco Tortorici, and John Miedema of Biological Carbon LLC. So the three of those folks partnered with Port Townsend Paper Corporation. Roger Hagen has been a tremendous supporter of this project, and I really can't understate just how successful we've been due to his enthusiasm for the project. So the paper mill produces biochar as a byproduct of its cogen operation.
On purpose?
It does. I should say it's a byproduct right now. And so what they would typically do with that char is refire, is to reintroduce it into their boilers and burn it again until it's rendered as
ash. Well, it's fortuitous to be right next to a company, a factory that makes this stuff, whether it wants to or not. It, as you say, a byproduct. So
yes.
What good fortune.
Tremendously fortunate for us. And also, again, Roger Hagen was really keen on this project and trying to find out if that byproduct could, in fact, help the port and potentially, at a regional scale, a lot of other facilities that are struggling to meet those benchmarks as well. And so he very generously had a crew of people hand rinsing the biochar in order to precipitate out the fines that we didn't want in there. There's a granular size that, through our investigations, we discovered was optimal for seeking a balance, kind of a sweet spot, if you will, between flow rates that we needed to see because we couldn't plug our system, and also maximum contact time so we get the highest level of efficacy. And so we think that we have found that sweet spot. And so now through our work, we've been able to find out what processes need to be put in place to screen the material, to rinse it, and then, of course, how to deliver stormwater to it and through it. And so one of the innovative aspects of the design work that came out of this collaborative process was that we discovered that an upstream flow, in other words, introducing the stormwater under a certain amount of head and pushing it through the material upward and then out, had a most beneficial effect. So very different from the types of systems that we typically see. Stormwater RX, for example, is a vendor that we've purchased equipment from that uses a gravity flow over a distributed field of material. And there they use various levels of different sieve size sand, and then a layer of granulated activated carbon as well.
So let's measure the results. You are looking at the stormwater. You're monitoring it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you capturing enough zinc to satisfy the Department of Ecology's regulations?
The short answer is we don't know yet. We moved from a pilot scale project where we installed one downspout tote that captured stormwater from one of the older galvanized roofs with a very high zinc load, and we did we compared our pilot tote to a stormwater RX tote side by side on the same roof area. Both of them achieved precisely the same effectiveness for removing zinc, which was 99.9%.
Well, that should be good enough.
We thought it was enough to warrant a larger scale investigation, so we moved into what we're calling a feasibility study now. We were able to attract the interest of the Washington State Department of Commerce, who awarded us a $50,000 grant to continue our investigations of biochar.
Okay. The Department of Ecology is supportive and cooperative?
They are, and I have to say, you know, this has been an iterative process. When the Level 3 response engineer report was submitted to the Department of Ecology, we had just started to investigate biochar as a potential medium for us to use there for filtration. And so we put in that report kind of a placeholder for biochar. And we asked Ecology that if it was discovered through our pilot scale testing that there was a demonstrated efficacy, whether or not we could substitute certain stormwater infrastructure improvements for biochar, if we could place a different media type in there, the biochar, substituting for what originally was going to be oyster shell. And so because another media that has a proven track record for efficacy of heavy metal removal. And so so the Department of Ecology said, absolutely, let's try this. So what I discovered at a regional stormwater conference last spring, was that the best and the brightest in the field are really struggling to figure out how to curb zinc exceedances. And so the Department of Ecology, I think, was a little bit excited to hear that, you know, little old Port of Port Townsend was doing some investigative work in what was initially showing some good promise.
So aside from wanting water to be clean, there's another very significant incentive for satisfying the conditions of the permit, NPDES permit, water quality permit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is that if the port does not satisfy the conditions, the boatyard is shut down.
That's correct.
I mean, that is the worst that could happen. And considering the number of jobs in marine trades here, considering the number of people who work on their own boats here, that would be catastrophic.
It would. We're talking about more than 400 marine trades jobs that are directly related to our facility there. So it would be huge, not just in terms of the economy here, but also the cultural fabric of our community. And so much of that, you know, having a working waterfront in a small town like this is increasingly rare. And so, I've had a few sleepless nights waking up and thinking about, you know, the weight of the work that I'm doing here and what's in play. And I should say that when I first started, I kept hearing sort of a note of exceptionalism among the marine trades and port supporters, which was that there's no way the Department of Ecology would ever shut down the boat haven, because after all, it's a cornerstone of our culture here. Well, the Department of Ecology feels a tremendous amount of pressure from other groups as well of environmental concerns. And they should. And so if you look at the record over the last 10 years for the number of boatyards that have lost their permits, it's pretty sobering. So it could happen here. And so rather than pretend that it couldn't, we should, I think, really focus on just getting under those benchmarks and preserving the boatyard permit that way.
And is the port satisfying everyone but zinc presently?
No, copper. While we were moving forward with the level 3 response for zinc, we moved into a level 3 response for copper as well. We had failed six times within the 5-year period that the boatyard permit is active, we had failed to achieve those benchmarks.
And I am not going to say this is because you were not strict enough with people working on their boats, because much of what is being put into the stormwater by heavy rains is already in the soil in much of the boat haven, where there is no doubt ongoing contributions to material in the soils, because much of the boat haven yard, rather boat yard, is still dirt. Mm-hmm. So it's what was there. We have a sailboat in the marina, as you know, and probably many listeners know by now from having listened to the show. We moved our boat from the section of the boat haven near the boatyard to as far away as we could get.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the summer westerly blows, we knew what was in that dust that blew on top of our boat.
Mm-hmm.
And until the yard is paved, it's going to be hard to control what comes into your system. Is there talk about paving? It's expensive.
It is, and we will be crunching the numbers to see what an asphalt overlay would cost. Bear in mind that in order to, for example, in the shipyard, we would be looking at better than 11 inches in thickness of asphalt there. So,
and the reason for that is
like,
the weight.
That's a foot. That's not quite a foot.
That's right.
That's a lot.
It is.
Yeah.
I should also point out that one of the first investigations I did was to find out whether or not soils in the boatyard in areas that had historically received a lot of contaminant load.
Copper.
Copper in particular.
Mostly.
Whether or not those soils were leaching and contributing to the stormwater. And what we discovered was that they weren't.
Really?
And so if you think about it, for all the issues that come up with having a gravel boatyard there, we just replaced a 100-foot by 400-foot section of gravel to a depth of 3 inches, because what I also discovered was that there's a huge difference, a marked difference in the level of contamination between 3 inches and 6 inches, or I should say between 2 inches and 6 inches. So you know, with most of the contaminant load actually being in the first inch of gravel there. So we excavated a 100-foot by 400-foot section down to 3 inches.
Where did you?
This is in the shipyard area.
Okay.
And then, so 352 tons of material was disposed of. So if you think about it, from 1997 until today, for $60,000, that gravel adequately entrained all of that pollutant load. You can't find a cheaper filter media.
I'm very surprised, but I'm also now puzzled at where and how the material is getting into the wastewater. The stormwater, I mean. Stormwater.
Well, it's flowing with the sheet flow off of the tarps.
So it actually is current work being done on boats.
Mm-hmm.
It is not work done in past decades.
No.
I guess with that logic, you might imagine if you had asphalt, that might increase it. You'd have less of these specific chemicals and elements that you're talking about soaking in, and more of them running off.
That's correct, which would require larger scale downstream filtration.
Well, it's backwards from what I thought, and I'm very interested to hear this.
It was for me, too, and that's why we did the investigative work that we did.
Yeah, let's not talk about the boatyard anymore, because, by the way, we're cutting into Al Cairns the DJ time, and we don't want to cut too far in.
No.
We've talked nothing but the boatyard, but how about the marina? How about people and their boats?
In general, I think that the level of compliance with our best management practices is pretty high there. I think most of the boat owners there are, I would say, exceptionally well-educated about why the BMPs are in place and why they need to be adhered to.
So there's no problems that the Department of Ecology is finding with, say, fecal coliform in the water in the Boat Haven?
No.
So we're cool in the water, but on the land, we're
on the hard,
troubled still.
It's,
on the hard, we're troubled still.
Yeah. But I have to say, the culture shift that I've witnessed since I've been there, owing to a growing awareness of the gravity of this moment among the marine trades, has been very welcomed by me. And I have found the marine trades people to be really a joy to work with. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a deeper pool of talent anywhere on the West Coast than we have there. And so I'm fairly humbled day in and day out with the level of craftsmanship that I see there, the level of talent. And so I think that if we can borrow just a little bit from that pool of talent in affecting some relatively small changes in the way that we do business there, that we'll achieve those benchmarks.
I have a couple more questions for Al, but I'm going to suggest to Emily, who's running the board, that we have two CDs and the CD players, and Al is going to hand you one from his collection here very soon. Last question is, but how about private boat owners? Are they generally cooperative as well? Have you had any problems with individuals? And I'll point out to people, I've pointed out to people that in high school, you were a wrestler. you have something of the bulldog about you. I wouldn't want to cross you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I haven't had – well, not with any of our moorage customers. With fishermen, I have had to employ a more colorful language sometimes.
Oh, you're a tugboat man. I'm sure you know some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that knowing that vernacular has been helpful. But in general, you know, we really haven't had any scenes that would make me nervous.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But, well, you are trained in nonviolent techniques, actually. I mean, the way that we met was over a scholarship awarded to high school students for community service and peace-oriented activities. So even though you do know the vernacular, and even though you were a wrestler in high school, you have other skills as well. Al Cairns will soon be Al Cairns the DJ. Thank you, by the way, for talking with me about the port.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure in every respect. Toss Salad does continue with Al Cairns the DJ in just a moment. He will tell Emily, who's going to be running the show for the next hour, I will be just sitting back and listening, what he's going to be playing. And as I have advertised his set, it will be the sorts of music that if I were choosing the music here, it probably wouldn't be the same. Al's tastes are different from mine, and that's one reason I invite him here.